Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, as we approach Thanksgiving, we look at those who are less fortunate this holiday, those who are going hungry. A new report is out, the Fresno Hunger Count. It aims to document in a new way the issue of food insecurity. We'll talk to its author and Andy Souza from the Community Food Bank. We'll also find out why the city of Hanford is struggling to balance two priorities: growth on the fringe with new developments like Costco on the way, at the same time as trying to revive a downtown that just a few years ago was thriving. Mike Iman of the Hanford Sentinel will join us. Right now, though, we turn our attention to politics. There's a civil war of sorts among California Democrats these days. Environmentalists want stronger efforts to fight climate change, while advocates for minorities and the poor raise concerns of higher gas and electric prices. California's next assembly leader is a Latino environmentalist who thinks he can bridge that gap. Anthony Rendon will take over as speaker early next year, giving California two Latino legislative leaders for the first time ever. KPCC's Leslie Berenstein Rojas has this profile.
To get to Anthony Rendon's office, you have to weave around trucks, pass an oil refinery, pass an aircraft parts factory. It's a heavily industrial part of Los Angeles County. It doesn't take long to notice the air. To be honest, it doesn't smell great.
If your child has asthma and you live along the freeway, there's nothing abstract about that.
Inside his office, Rendon tells me a little about his district. There's lots of industry, three freeways, two major ports. Here, pollution's not something you just talk about. It's kind of in your face.
Right here down the street, you turn on the tap water in Maywood, it's brown.
Rendon grew up in a working-class family in predominantly Latino neighborhoods of L.A. County. He's attended all three branches of California's higher education system, community college, CSU, and UC. Then he spent years in the nonprofit world, advocating for early childhood education and the environment. He won his assembly seat in 2012. The third-generation Mexican-American usually pronounces his name Rendon, not Rendon. He wonders if it might have to do with people calling his family Rendon since the 1920s, when the first of his grandparents arrived. In the assembly, Rendon played a key role in developing the water bond voters approved last year, and he's had stints chairing two powerful committees, including Utilities and Commerce, whose members include Republican Assemblyman David Hadley. Hadley calls Rendon a good guy, but says he's presided over too many party-line committee votes.
I'm hoping that we can get through some of the hard work of finding common ground in committees rather than just have things passed through committee on a party-line vote and then negotiated on the floor.
Loyola Marymount political scientist Fernando Guerra says Rendon's background will shape his agenda as speaker.
Number one will be education. Number two, I think it will be labor. Number three, I think it will be the environment. And he's going to pick up the mantle from Kevin DeLeon and others who have been pushing a new environmental regime.
Rendon won the speakership just days before Senate Leader DeLeon's controversial push to cut vehicle petroleum use in half faltered in the assembly, where many Democrats who represent poor districts said their constituents couldn't afford higher gas prices. Rendon says his time leading the L.A. County nonprofit Plaza de la Raza Child Development Services gave him a stark sense of how families of color live with pollution.
We found that a lot of the problems we have, whether they were problems relating to health or problems relating to even learning and education, were linked to the environment.
Rendon knows he's sort of an anomaly in the mainstream environmental movement. Its leadership tends to be mostly non-Latino white, rooted locally on the west side of Los Angeles. He thinks he can be a bridge between environmentalists and residents in places like his district, which is majority Latino, largely working class, and straddles a major urban freeway.
It's a missed opportunity for progressives. It's a missed opportunity for the environmental movement.
Rendon will have time on his side as he mounts his agenda. He'll be the first assembly speaker elected under California's new term limits law, so he could remain in power for nearly a decade. In Los Angeles, I'm Leslie Berenstein Rojas.
California's bullet train project has faced new criticism in recent weeks. Its leaders have been accused of hiding higher cost estimates and failing to win funding from the private sector. One recent attack by a Fresno lawmaker caught the attention of Capital Public Radio's PolitiFact reporter, Chris Nichols.
Plans to build a high-speed rail network from L.A. to San Francisco rely heavily on private funding. This summer, the California High-Speed Rail Authority asked private companies for advice. It asked them how to make its $68 billion bullet train plan more efficient and more appealing to investors. More than 30 companies responded with ideas and some concerns. Soon after, Republican Assemblyman Jim Patterson of Fresno told the L.A. Times, quote, "We now know these firms are unwilling to put up any private money," end quote. He made a similar statement on a Central Valley TV show.
"We are now finding out that there really is no private money."
Questions about the project's huge costs and lack of funding have dogged the Rail Authority for years. But was Patterson right that the private sector has already written off the bullet train as a bad investment? We decided to ask the companies themselves.
I think a correct way to look at that is that the project is too early for the private sector to have committed money.
That's Stephen Policronis, a vice president with AECOM, one of the firms that responded to the Rail Authority's request for advice.
We're only at that very first stage where the authority has asked for expressions of interest, not proposals, but interest.
Michael Cahill, a Siemens executive, also rejected the idea that his firm has given up on the rail network. He told the Sacramento Bee there wasn't an opportunity to fund the project, which, quote, "doesn't mean we wouldn't be interested, quite the opposite," end quote. Private firms have expressed many concerns about the project. None have stepped forward with funding to date. Several companies advised the Rail Authority that financial markets won't be able to fund the huge venture unless its contracts are broken into smaller pieces.
What the private sector has said is that it is not willing to take many of the risks that the project would entail as of now.
That's Lou Thompson, head of the project's independent oversight panel. Patterson, for his part, told us he stands by his statement that the private sector is turning its back to high-speed rail through his spokeswoman. But after hearing directly from several private firms, it's clear they are playing a waiting game. We rate Patterson's claim that they are unwilling to fund the bullet train as mostly false. The statement contains some element of truth, but ignores critical facts that would give a different impression. You can read full versions of all our fact checks at politifactcalifornia.com. At the state capitol, I'm Chris Nichols.
Listen next week on Valley Edition for another fact check from PolitiFact California, this time on a claim by the Rail Authority's CEO. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Hunger is a problem in the San Joaquin Valley throughout the year. Of course, it's an issue that's at the front of mind for many in this holiday season, as we have two guests with us in our studio today to tell us more about what's happening on the ground in the Fresno area when it comes to food insecurity. We have with us Andy Souza. He is the CEO of the Community Food Bank in Fresno, and Philip Arrow. He is the force behind a new effort to quantify the issue of hunger in the area. It's called Fresno Hunger Count. I want to start with you, Philip. Why did you get involved with this effort to look at this issue in a new way and do this essentially census of hunger in the valley?
Well, it really started with an article in our local newspaper, the Fresno Bee, and it was describing how much hunger there was in Fresno, how severe it was, and how widespread it was. And after I read that article, some months went by, and then I donated to the Community Food Bank and engaged Andy Souza in a conversation. And basically what he said was that his organization was doing a lot to get food to people, and there were other organizations doing similar things, but no one really knew how much hunger was out there. And we had a series of conversations after that, And we came up with the idea of doing a survey where we actually interview the people who are in need and let them state what the needs are. So that was the conception of the project.
So you went throughout homes in the Fresno area and interviewed people and came up with some really interesting statistics. Over half of the Fresno Clovis households surveyed experienced food shortages. The cost of additional food to nourish them, $41.5 million. How did you arrive at those numbers, and how did this survey exactly work? Did you survey all households or only certain neighborhoods, or how did you come to that conclusion?
Right. Well, we took the median income of people in various census tracts, and so what we did was we selected the census tracts where the median income was 200% of the level of poverty, federal poverty level. And that's $48,000 for a family of four. So we ended up identifying 75 census tracts. Those were in Pinedale and then from Shaw south throughout Fresno. So it was 75 census tracts, all based on the median income being 200% of the poverty level or less.
And I want to turn now to Andy Souza of the Community Food Bank. Looking at these numbers, more than 64,000 people, according to a Phillips survey, have empty fridges. 80% of them don't have enough meat, bread, fruits, and veggies. 71% of those individuals have small children and not enough milk. Were you surprised at the numbers that the Fresno Hunger Count came up with?
Joe, no, we really weren't. For the reason is Phil and I engaged very early in this process, and we just kind of put a little more frame around the context as well. We know on a macro level, very large numbers. We know throughout our five-county region, Fresno, Madera, Kings, Tulare, and Kern counties, that one in three children and one in four adults. But when you drill it down to a neighborhood, that's where we lose that information. And so it was very helpful for what Phil and his team did. And those weren't shocking for the neighborhoods they looked at because, as he mentioned, as you're looking at those pockets of concentrated poverty that we know the Brookings Institute has told us about since 2005, what we're seeing is very consistent, not only in the numbers of people but the high need for your lean proteins, your fruits and vegetables. Joe, when you're in a situation where you're on a very tight budget, it is really easy to get your high-calorie, low-nutritional foods, your macaroni and cheese, your top ramen noodles, your puff sugar cereal. But when you start getting into the fruits and vegetable aisle, it gets a little more expensive, and it's tougher for families to make ends meet there. So, yeah, we've seen consistently on a macro level everything Phil saw really down there on the neighborhood-by-neighborhood, block-by-block, house-by-house analysis.
You mentioned the consistency there, Andy. How have things changed, perhaps, in the last 5 years or so? Has there been any change, or is this just sort of the status quo in many of these neighborhoods, as you said, that deal with the consistent high levels of concentrated poverty?
Well, Joe, I think what we saw is a little bit inconsistent or counterintuitive, which is probably a better term. We went through the tough recession, and we saw a lot of families that would have never expected they were going to be in our lines. We're serving them. Families with two college educations who both lost their job, or one member in the household lost their job and another one was furloughed. So we would consider that was situational. And many of those families have pulled back out. But, Joe, many haven't. And many are still struggling. And hidden in all the discussion is really what we're seeing is a lot of underemployment. Folks just aren't where they were before the recession hit. And so they may not need us every month, but they might need us every other month or every third month or when the transmission goes out or something big happens. So that's kind of the state we're seeing across our region. It's ironically, the urban areas are actually improving, as you can imagine, quicker than the rural areas. The rural areas, obviously impacted by the drought, have really, really struggled in making ends meet in those areas. And so I think we're seeing consistent with that. But one thing that's also telling is that it's not just in those neighborhoods that Phil looked at. You know, we went through and we look a lot at not only
census tract data by census block, but we also look at free and reduced meals throughout our five counties. And, you know, my wife and I live up in the Woodward Park area, and I drive by Valley Oak every day, Valley Oak Elementary School. Never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that one in five kids at Valley Oak are on free and reduced meals. That's at the corner of Friant and Champlain, just next to Holy Spirit Church there. 20% of the kids, six kids in every classroom, are getting nutritional food assistance through the schools. So it is in every neighborhood. It's woven throughout our community. Where Phil and his folks have really reached out are really those high need, that concentration area. But it's and that's really where the big needs are. But it's in every neighborhood.
That voice you hear is Andy Souza. He is the CEO of the Community Food Bank in Fresno. Also with us today on this discussion of hunger in the Valley is Philip Arrow. He is behind the new effort to quantify hunger in some of Fresno's most distressed neighborhoods. It's called the Fresno Hunger Count. Philip, I asked Andy if there was anything that surprised him in this. Was there anything that surprised you in this process?
Yes, there was. Basically, I had thought prior to the survey that that the hunger was concentrated right around downtown. So you would look maybe north of downtown to the Lowell Elementary School area, maybe east of downtown to the First and Belmont area, and then west of downtown to southwest Fresno. But what we found was that there are concentrations of hunger throughout the city, and it's kind of like a leopard skin. When you look at this, when it's expressed on a map, you see these red spots all over the 75 census tracts that we surveyed. And I want to say at this point that we surveyed census tracts west of the 99 as well as east of the 99. So this is widespread. It goes very wide, and it goes north-south as well.
And jumping off on something that Andy mentioned earlier, this discussion of this, the access to food. It's not just about people having enough food. In some cases, we have these this issue of food deserts, neighborhoods where there isn't a grocery store. Maybe there's a corner store that sells liquor and beer and sort of junk foods type snacks, high calorie, not necessarily the most nutritious type of food. How much of that is also a part of this problem in your view?
Well, availability of groceries is a big problem. These grocery chains do their homework as far as the demographics of a given area. They want to be sure that the median income is high enough that people will come in and spend their money, and the grocery store has to be close enough to them to come in. So what you have in many of these neighborhoods is a complete absence of supermarkets. Many of these people, even when they get their paycheck, they can drive to the store, but it may be that they have to put $5 of gasoline in their car because they're going to go to the grocery store and then maybe do a few other things. They're very close to just not being able to get around. They do have an old beat-up car in many instances, or they get around on a bus. But if you've ever shopped and got on a bus, you know they can't carry too many bags of groceries. So the fact that a grocery store is not close is a major item for these people.
Andy, I want to turn that question to you now. A few weeks ago on this program, we did a couple of stories about West Fresno and the challenges it faces and also some of the success stories. One of the success stories was the Kearney Palm Shopping Center. If I remember
yes.
correctly, you were city manager at the time that opened, and that really has been cited as a success story. And the Food Max there, many thought it wasn't going to be successful. In fact, it's turned out to be one of the best performing stores in that chain. How do you see that issue of food deserts playing into this? Is that a part of this equation as we look at not just access to food, but also what food people have access to?
Well, first of all, Joe, I thank you for the compliment, but it was prior to my time
it
as city manager.
Prior. Okay.
But you know what? And I want to be fair on that because I'm sure some of your listeners are going to go, no way he was. But I was a city controller at the time. And yeah, that was a great project. I mean, that is one that you know, it's always a struggle when you've got to make a major investment into something like that of limited tax dollars. But the fruit that bore through the redevelopment agency at the time and what we see now is that is a case that I had the opportunity to share with on this issue with – there was a National Hunger Commission, Congressional Hunger Commission that traveled across the country, and I was lucky enough to be one of the people to speak to them in Oakland earlier this year. And that's exactly one of the things we talked about is the need for public-private partnerships like that to start addressing food deserts, because at the end of the day, the families we're serving, even in the best of times, have very limited resources. And as Phil mentioned, if you're putting $5, $6, $8 into the gas tank to get you to the Super Walmart in Kerman and then have to drive all the way back to Tranquility or to Firebaugh or to Mendota or wherever you might be, that's just resources that mean you're going to be longer in the, you know, top ramen and the high calorie, low nutrition area rather than your lean proteins or your fruits and vegetables. So, yeah, it's an issue that has gone nationwide, has a lot of discussion, Joe, and it's something that all of us in the food, you know, food banking world or the food assistance world understand that we as food banks, we're not going to solve hunger by ourselves. Passing out a bag of food isn't going to solve hunger. It's critical and it's crucial for the families we serve, and I don't ever want to diminish that. But it's going to take more of a holistic approach. It's got to be the economics these families are dealing with. It has to be access to reasonably priced nutritional food. So, yeah, Joe, food deserts are something that are on the radar for most of us, and it's something that, especially in the kind of urban-rural split that we have here in our region, make a big impact on some of these families.
How difficult is that on that urban-rural split that you just mentioned? How difficult is it for an organization like yours to meet the needs of the people out there? Just logistically, you mentioned that in some cases the urban area is coming back, but the rural areas are struggling. We have the drought. We have the high farm-related unemployment due to the drought. Talk about those challenges that you're facing there, because you cover a huge area and many of these communities, very small, very rural, very remote. Yeah. And what is your outreach to them?
Yeah. Well, Joe, you're spot on. I mean, it's an ironic way we have to do business, but we always have to remind ourselves at the end of the day, a child who's hungry in Mendota or Cantua Creek is no different than a child that's hungry in Southeast Fresno. It's a hungry child, and we've got to figure out a way to get there. And thankfully, you know, what we've been able to do is really build strong relationships in those communities. If you circle back to the 2009 drought, and that was when I was still at City Hall, the model that was used, and it was a very efficient model, was to get all the food in Fresno and then take it out to Mendota or take it out to Firebaugh or take it out to Tranquility with a lot of Fresno volunteers. And you were literally a little bit of the cavalry coming. And we just felt like that wasn't a good model because it didn't help build community sustainability. So we were real intentional this year with the drought relief to want to make sure we're partnering with existing organizations in Orange Cove, in Huron, in San Joaquin. And what that's helped do is just build their infrastructure as well so that they're equipped that once the drought's over, because it will end, the economy isn't great in those communities. As you know, if you think of Firebaugh, Mendota, you're still talking persistently 18 to 20% unemployment, even you know when we have full cooperative weather and cooperative water systems, it's still a tough economy in those regions. So it is, but we know, Joe, going at the end of the day that you know, we just build a model that serves that area. That's where we're at. We don't have the luxury of being San Francisco with, you know, 49 square miles all self-contained. But, you know, we have great donors. We have great agricultural support. We have great business support that help us build this infrastructure to make it happen.
Andy, you mentioned agricultural support. I know there's been some talk out there of some legislation that could potentially make it easier for agriculture companies to donate food and things like that. Does your organization have a position on that in any way?
Yes, and the position is yes.
Joe, and tell us a little about what that involves.
Sure, Joe. Let me frame that discussion a little bit as well, because when I started at the food bank, we were receiving about 3 million pounds of fresh produce, and a lot of that was because you know, we just it's busy, and I've discovered through the course of life, you tend to think that folks see life as you see it. We're food banks, and people should just know that we're food banks, but what we discovered is the agriculture community is very giving if you ask. And you just have to remember to ask. And so we started asking. And we've been able to grow from 3 million pounds a year of fresh produce to last year it was just over 17 million pounds. And that was the vast majority of that, 15.5 million pounds, were literally donated, where folks either said, come pick it up or we'll deliver it to you. We might have a little bit of freight cost, but that's donated itself. The legislation we talked about has been at both the federal and state level, and that is the ability for folks to get an accelerated benefit for lack of a better term, for donating produce. The challenge is most of the laws are written around corporate structures where they're accrual-based accounting and it's very inventory-based, and there's a lot of paperwork that's done that your average farming entity doesn't do. They're cash-based accounting. And so what we're hoping to do is maintain the intent and the spirit of the law, just turn it in a manner that makes it available to your smaller growers, your smaller farms, your smaller packing houses that don't have a reason to be on an accrual-based accounting system for their taxes, but yet have a philanthropic heart. They want to make a difference, and they want to add value to our community.
Turning back now to Philip Arrow of Fresno Hunger Count, we're talking about this new data that's out, that his survey looked at many census tracts in the Fresno-Clovis area, and of the ones they looked at, over half of the households in those census tracts surveyed experienced food shortages. What's the next step for you, both in terms of your data and addressing the problem your data uncovered?
Well, thank you, Joe. Basically, we have contacted and reported our data to the Community Food Bank and many of the other organizations that provide relief food. And so what we intend to do with that is that we report to them where some needs are that they may not be taking care of now. And so we're hoping that the existing organizations can deliver food to new locations or deliver to the same locations but at different dates, because we're identifying when the food is needed, where it's needed, the types of foods that are needed, and amount for each type of food every month in 75 census tracts. So these organizations, when we give them this information, we can show them where there's a need within, for example, 2 miles of their headquarters, let's say. And so it's a way to enable these organizations to meet needs that are not being met now. And I've had discussions with Andy and with the people at the Central Valley Community Foundation about this notion that, okay, we've identified the needs, but now we're going to have to find a way to get funding to increase the capacity of these organizations so that they can increase their distribution, even if they do get free food from some source. So that's kind of the next steps. And I would like to, at this point, urge our listeners to increase the amount of help and support they're giving to Community Food Bank, and perhaps if they belong to a church that has a pantry, to increase that. These are needs. This 26 million pounds of food are needed in addition to what all these organizations are doing now. And so we need to increase our support of all these organizations. It can be in some instances, some families don't have much money. They can have a member or two members of their family dedicate 2 hours a week or a month, depending on their schedules. So there's that very vital contribution of volunteering for these organizations. They can contribute small sums, $2 a month, $10 a month, whatever they can afford. Other people can afford more, but everybody needs to commit. We have 192,000 households just in the city of Fresno and the city of Clovis. If everybody would just do something and realize how important it is to invest in nutrition, because if we invest in this nutrition, our unborn, our newly born children, and our young children will get that that first learning. They'll have normal brain development. They'll be able to learn in preschool and kindergarten, and as they go through our educational system, that nutrition will be there all along. So when they become juniors and seniors in high school, if they get into a project that really inspires them, even a student who has been only a, an indifferent student all his life or her life, that person may just really be energized by a certain project, and then they start really taking off. And those are the people that I'm thinking of that go to places like Bitwise Industries, and they get into software. They become very proficient at writing software and know how to sense a certain need for a certain kind of software and market their software well. Those are the kinds of people that we can grow right here in Fresno if we give them nutrition. So I think an investment in nutrition has a very big reward, having these young professionals who are very motivated staying here in Fresno.
Yeah, and certainly this is a problem that's not, as Andy said, just Fresno, also with rural communities, also in Tulare and Kings County and Kern County as well. Andy, what is the most effective way that people can help? There's a lot of different things that people can do. You talked about trying to look at how organization can make the biggest impact and trying to do things in different ways, simply by maybe asking in a different way than you have before. What is the one way that you or the ways, I should say, that you feel people out there who are listening right now can help most effectively your organization?
Sure. Joe, the easiest way, and it's one that's always just you're a little bit cautious because you don't want it to sound so mercenary. But really for us, the best way is a financial investment. If they were to go to our website, communityfoodbank.net, hit the donate now button. You think about the fact that we distribute 38 million pounds of food on about a $5 million budget. So we can move a lot of food based on having cash available. And it really rings back to something, and I should have mentioned very early in the discussion, because when Phil and I first met to have this discussion, a lot of this discussion was about the fact that the food banking world and the food access and food support world tends to be more reactionary in the sense that we distribute what is given to us. And part of what Phil's data tells us is these are the things, and he mentioned just a moment ago, that there are things we need to be intentional about going and getting. And we need to shift our model from being simply reactionary to building in that proactive component. How do you go, if folks aren't going to donate dairy products just because the economics and marketing orders and those things that get in the way, then we need to figure out a way to go access it from another manner, whether it's financial donations or whatever that looks like. So because if the need out there is dairy products for young children, you know, we can pass out everything else and they're still missing that dairy need. So one of the things that's always been exciting for us with Phil's work and the Hunger Count work is the fact that it's opening up to not just when and where, but what. And really helping us narrow down that as we become proactive in how we access and distribute food, we're making sure that we're getting the right food on the tables and the right food distributed to the families that are in need. So that was a big part of Phil's work that really has helped us a lot.
You can find the data as part of the Fresno Hunger Count survey online at hunger-count.org. You can also find the Community Food Bank and connect with them online for donations at communityfoodbank.net. We've been talking with Andy Souza of the Community Food Bank and Philip Arrow of Fresno Hunger Count. Thank you so much for joining us today, and happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Joe, thank you very much.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and learn what the city of Hanford is doing to try to revive its downtown and how new commercial developments are changing the face of the city. That's coming up in the next segment on Valley Edition. Straight ahead.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now.
Your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
...2015 has been an exciting year at Valley Public Radio. In May, we broke ground on our new broadcast center, and construction has moved along quickly. Workers are now installing electrical systems, and the drywall is next. But before we move in next spring, we need to finish the job. Our partners at the James Irvine Foundation have issued a challenge. If we raise $200,000 by the end of 2015 for the building project, they will match it with an additional $200,000. It's the largest challenge in the history of Valley Public Radio. Your tax-deductible donation or multi-year pledge can help us finish the job and move in on time. Click the Donate button at kvpr.org or call us at 1-800-275-0764.
This is Valley Edition. Dyslexia is a common learning disability. About 20% of Americans are estimated to be living with it. Yet it can still be difficult for kids with dyslexia to get the right kind of educational services. A new law in California seeks to make it easier. Capital Public Radio's Katie Orr reports.
Ian Kennedy and his mom, Katrina Kennedy, sit at their dining table working on one of their daily lessons.
We just gotta work on seeing those words. So you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, ready, set, go.
Click, win, quill, quest, witch, quip.
Ian runs quilt, through a list of words as his mom times him. Ian has dyslexia. The exercise is meant to help with his phonological processing. That's his ability to pull apart the sounds within words and associate the sounds with letters.
Quack.
31 seconds. So a little slower than then. But look at the first time it was 42 seconds.
Ian is an outgoing 10-year-old who has visions of starting his own YouTube channel and one day becoming a video game developer. But in first grade, Katrina and her husband noticed Ian was becoming hesitant to read. In kindergarten, he was reading basic words, but he was struggling with the more intense reading lessons that came in first grade. When they expressed concern, Katrina says they were told they should just wait to see how things developed. Ian was eventually diagnosed with dyslexia. Still, Katrina says the diagnosis didn't make things any easier. Ian was falling behind, working through recess, and acting out at home.
About halfway through third grade, we, as a family, were really having a hard time managing the amount of homework. Nobody wanted to come home. Nobody wanted to face it.
Ian and his parents decided Katrina would homeschool him. The change has brought a sense of calm and control back into their lives, but the family remains frustrated by what they saw as a lack of support from Ian's school. Katrina says the accommodations the school made for Ian only added to his stress. Now a new state law requires schools to consider phonological processing when evaluating a child for special education. Toby Meyer is with Decoding Dyslexia California. She led the effort to pass the law after she ran into resistance while trying to get educational help for her son's dyslexia.
The law is going to help future students to be identified or be found eligible for special education services more easily than they had been in the past.
The law will also create new guidelines to help teachers and parents identify dyslexia and provide services for students who have it. Dr. Sally Shaywitz thinks the law is a step in the right direction. She co-directs the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Shaywitz says early intervention is critical to treating dyslexia. So is overcoming the idea that people who have dyslexia aren't smart.
Part of the definition of dyslexia is that it is an unexpected difficulty in reading, unexpected meaning. It occurs in people who are quite intelligent.
Shaywitz welcomes a U.S. Senate resolution defining the disorder and calling on schools to recognize its educational impact. And a recent letter from the U.S. Department of Education to state and local education agencies clarifies it's okay to use the term dyslexia when discussing a child's education. Ian Kennedy is reading better because of the exercises he does to recognize sounds within words. And he's not ashamed of having dyslexia.
I feel unique. I feel like a lot of people in this world don't know about it, but it's there.
In Sacramento, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The city of Hanford has undergone a lot of changes over the years. One thing that has stayed the same, the city's picturesque downtown. Many listeners probably can relate to going to Superior Dairy on the town square, enjoying an ice cream, maybe even going to a movie or a performance at the Fox Theater. The city has also grown on the fringe. A new Costco is slated to start construction in the coming years. There's a lot of discussion, though, about the future of Hanford, those developments on the fringe, and the future of downtown. Here to tell us more about some of the latest happenings in that Kings County county seat is Mike Iman. He is the city government reporter with the Hanford Sentinel. He joins us today on Valley Edition. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote an article about a week and a half ago about the city doing a survey of its downtown and looking at all of the vacancies that are in the neighborhood. That sort of caught my attention because I go to Hanford maybe a few times a year, enjoy going to a place like Superior Dairy or maybe some of the antique stores and restaurants. I've always thought of Hanford as having a real vibrant downtown, the farmer's market and things like that. But I guess things have sort of fallen on hard times in recent years.
I think it kind of took the same kind of hit like most cities did when the economy kind of took a turn for the worse over the last few years. I think things are kind of picking up again. But you look at the way downtown Hanford is right now, and there's some vacancies. I don't think there's as many as some people would tell you, but the ones that are there are fairly prominent. And so I think it's kind of waiting on some sort of trendy something or other to come in and fill those vacancies and start drawing people to downtown for more than just Superior Dairy, although that is certainly a draw.
So what are city leaders trying to do?
One of the things that they did earlier this year is the majority of the council, this was kind of a divisive issue, but they started repealing some of these strict requirements for what types of businesses have to go downtown. So some of the things that they looked at were hotels and movie theaters. So until a few months ago, if you were a full-service hotel, which includes room service, on-site restaurant, those sorts of amenities, you could only be downtown. And so I think what some of the council members have been looking at is trying to open up more of a free market kind of approach, which is, if you're a hotel, you can go where you think you're going to do the best business, and we'll be maybe more receptive to other types of businesses that want to be downtown. So.
And movie theaters are also another key sticking point, right?
Right. So they did the same sort of thing with movie theaters. They opened it up a little bit. So if you're a movie theater, you don't have to go downtown, which kind of makes sense because I think there's been some discussion that I've heard. If you wanted to have a big Edwards type movie theater like Fresno has, where would you put it if it had to be downtown? And so I think that's a valid question. There were rumors going around after they started talking about this that there was a 12-screen movie theater that wanted to build downtown. Still no word on that, who the mystery developer was or if it was ever even a project. So we'll see what happens with that. As far as the hotels, though, I actually just did a story that ran today. There's actually a couple of hotel projects outside of the downtown area that are getting ready to get started since that rule changed.
There's also a lot of talk and some controversy as well about the planned Costco development on Lacey Boulevard on the east side of town. What is the latest on that? I understand that things are moving pretty quickly, but construction's not underway just yet.
Not just yet, but I think they're kind of in the final stretches of getting that going. Last I checked, the city just kind of has to finish getting all the rights of way on East Lacey Boulevard. So for part of this project, they have to relocate a section of East Lacey Boulevard leading up to Highway 43 and relocate the intersection. And Caltrans wants them to put in a roundabout there. Some locals are kind of a little cautious about that idea. But so they have to get the rights of way to some of these properties in order to relocate the street and put in the roundabout. So I think from what I'm being told is that Costco is pretty much waiting for that to all be done, that, just getting the rights of way, and then they'll be ready to pull a building permit. But they have their plans in, they're approved, they're ready to pull a permit as soon as all the conditions are ripe.
Now, in reporting on these stories, you've talked to business owners throughout the city. What is the general mood from them, especially maybe some of those in the downtown area, about the changes that have been underway? Certainly, there's been a lot of growth in Hanford, and you have demand, obviously, if Costco's talking about building a new store. They see that as a ripe market. What about some of the small business owners? What do they feel about the direction things are going?
Well, I think if you look around just how Hanford has grown over the past couple of decades, you do have this kind of like downtown's in the middle, and then you have 12th Avenue on one extreme of town, and then you're talking about building another commercial center on the opposite side, to the east. And so it kind of puts downtown in a weird position of you know, if I have a business downtown, I'm really going to have to do something to draw people to this part of town. Because if you want to go to Target or Walmart, you're heading over to the west. Or if you want to go to Costco pretty soon, you're going to be heading over to the east. And so I think some of these businesses are really going to have to do something to try to stand out and actually draw people to downtown. So I think that's the big concern. It's like, so what's going to happen to downtown once you have this kind of sandwich of commercial on one side, commercial on the other, and then small businesses in the middle?
One of the other draws in downtown Hanford has typically been the Fox Theater. I know this is a little outside of your normal beat of covering city government, but the Fox has been closed for some time due to some much-needed repairs and repairing the ceiling. There was an issue, I guess, over a year ago with the Fox, and they have made some of those repairs and are doing things. Is that slated to reopen anytime soon? And how much of a concern is that, having that open again, for the general neighborhood around there?
So I haven't done an update on that in probably a month or two, so I'm not exactly sure where they're at. I haven't heard an open date at this point, so I assume that they're still finishing up the construction. As far as the impact, all right, so the Fox Theater is, I think, really good at drawing people from outside of the area to downtown. But, I mean, most of the events they do are in the evening, and a lot of downtown businesses are closed in the evening. So I don't know how much of an impact it really has on surrounding businesses, although it's definitely a great way to get people coming downtown and at least seeing what it has to offer.
One of the other things moving on from downtown, but also part of city government that has been a big issue, is water conservation. The city of Hanford was one of the agencies cited by the State Water Board a while ago for water conservation. How is the city faring in trying to get in line with what the state wants to see on that front? What have you seen from City Hall in that regard?
Well, that's kind of a complicated one. It depends who you talk to. I mean, if you look strictly at the numbers as far as the conservation totals, I believe that they've been doing a little bit better in the last month or two. But they got off to such a rocky start that it's, you know, so they have to get to 28% conservation compared with 2013, and basically since they had such low conservation levels for a few months, that standard is basically, you know, even higher. So they're trying to do like kind of like a public information campaign. They're sending out flyers. They put up a special website. I think what it comes down to is people can only really conserve so much. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how the state handles that, because I don't think Hanford's the only one that's having some of these issues.
Before we go, coming back to where we started this conversation, so the city did this survey of vacancies downtown. What is the next step? Are they going to go up with a full new plan for the downtown area? I know there's been some talk about the east downtown area, trying to come up with a plan for that area, the China Alley district, and connecting that with the rest of downtown. What's the next step for the city in trying to look at a new vision for that area? I know there's also been some talk about trying to, you know, come up with those more trendy things. What's the new thing that is going to attract people? Maybe it's live workspaces, things like that. What's the next step in terms of city government dealing with that issue?
Well, I think the next step is that the council has actually been talking about this for a few months now as some sort of incentive package. So one of the things that they've kind of tentatively discussed is some sort of like sales tax refund, I believe. and just ways to make it easier on businesses to come downtown as opposed to if they wanted to start a business somewhere else. So just making it more appealing. But I think first, before they did anything like that, they wanted to look at the vacancies versus buildings that are actually can't be occupied. They're just so beyond out of repair. So if that happens to be something that they find is a real problem, they might try to tackle helping property owners as opposed to helping businesses or some combination of the two.
We've been talking with Mike Iman. He is the city government reporter for the Hanford Sentinel, covering city hall issues, everything from the new Costco that is going in on Lacey Boulevard near Highway 43 to efforts to revive Hanford's downtown area. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. As we close our show today, we have another in our series called My Valley, My Story, a collection of first-person accounts of life in the San Joaquin Valley. This week, reporter Diana Aguilera brings us the story of transgender activist Zoyer Zindel. He talks about the struggles he's faced and his hopes for the Valley's LGBTQ community.
My name is Zoyer Zindel, and I identify as a female-to-male transsexual, otherwise known as trans man, which means I was assigned female at birth, but I live my life as male, and so my sex did not correspond with my gender. Gender is a function of the brain, and I've always saw myself in my brain as a male. I think that I went through more drastic changes through my coming of age, coming out as an activist, rather than my coming out as a trans male. So I kind of feel like once, I got further along in my transition, I was like, oh, that's no big deal. I'm not sad about it anymore. I've just never really had a problem. It's a non-issue. It becomes an issue when I see others in my community being hurt, attacked, murdered, then I make it an issue. So even though I had, overall, a good experience, I know that that is not the norm, unfortunately. And so I feel compelled to do something about that. I think that a lot of isolation is what a lot of people experience. People feel alone. People feel invalidated. Imagine, if you never see your kind and represented in leadership like Fresno City Council, our bosses, our nurses, our doctors. I mean, they're there, but there's not a whole lot of them that are visible. For me, I personally have invested in this town and want to see our LGBT community and especially our transgender community grow. And so I'll be here till I die, and I'll be here till I die working on it because it's definitely needed.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like your comments. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us at kvpr. You can also find us online at kvpr.org, audio archives, podcasts, and more, all on our new mobile-friendly website. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.